The reading today is Ecclesiastes chapter 6. I have seen another evil under the sun, and it weighs heavily on men. God gives a man wealth, possessions, and honour, so that he lacks nothing his heart desires. But God does not enable him to enjoy them, and a stranger enjoys them instead. This is meaningless, a grievous evil. A man may have 100 children and live many years, yet no matter how long he lives, if he cannot enjoy his prosperity and does not receive proper burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he is. It comes without meaning, it departs in darkness, and in darkness its name is shrouded. Though it never saw the sun or knew anything, it has more rest than does that man, even if he lives 1,000 years twice over but fails to enjoy his prosperity. Do not all go to the same place? All man's efforts are for his mouth, yet his appetite is never satisfied. What advantage has a wise man over a fool? What does a poor man gain by knowing how to conduct himself before others? Better what the eye sees than the roving of the appetite. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Whatever exists has already been named, and what man is has been known. No man can contend with one who is stronger than he. The more the words, the less the meaning. And how does that profit anyone? For who knows what is good for a man in life during the few and meaningless days he passes through like a shadow? Who can tell him what will happen under the sun after he is gone?
Good morning. So good to be with you today on the Lord's Day. We continue on with our Ecclesiastes series, and this morning we're going to be looking at the doctrine of suffering, albeit in a pretty short amount of time together. Now, just looking back over the series so far, which we really hope you've been encouraged by, we've seen that the pursuit of things under the sun, chasing after worldliness, is vanity. If it is without God, not that these things are inherently wrong, but without God, central to them all, enjoying them as a gift from God, then they are vanity. You know, church life is so short, and there is so much more than just chasing after worldliness and chasing after money. And I was reminded of this very fact of a story told by Paul Tripp at our parenting course that we did last year. In one of his seminars, Tripp offered a radical challenge to some of his hearers that were struggling to put family before worldliness or chasing after the worldly things. He said, oh, what I want you to do is to consider going to your boss and asking for a demotion, take less pay. And this challenge greatly angered one particular man in the crowd, although Tripp didn't know that at the time. Until 2 years later, that man came over to Tripp during a conference break. And as he got closer, he began to weep. He said, 2 years ago, I heard you give that challenge you just gave to me today again. And I got really angry. I thought, what right do you have to say that? But I was actually haunted by your words. I thought, he's speaking to me. This is my whole life, which is away from my home, and I don't even know my own kids. I finally took your advice. I went to my boss one morning and said, I want to talk to you about my position. The boss said, look, we've advanced you as much as and as fast as we can. And I said, no, you just need to hear me. I want a demotion. The boss looked at him startled and asked, what are you talking about? I said, the most important thing in my life is not this job and making money. The most important thing is that God has given me 5 children and I'm an instrument in forming their souls. But right now, I don't even know my own kids. The boss said, I've never heard this kind of conversation before and I'll probably never hear it again. I'm very moved. Look, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll find you a position where you can work 40 hours a week. You can punch in and punch out and have less responsibility. But I'm really sorry. We can't pay you enough. We can't pay you what you've been getting paid. He said, that's fine. We sold the house of our dreams. We got rid of 2 luxury cars and brought a minivan. And it's been 2 years now. And do you know that since then and in that time, not one of my kids has come up to me and said, Dad, I wish we lived in that big house. Or, Dad, I wish we had those new fancy cars. But over and over again, they've come and said, Dad, we've been having so much fun with you. It's so great to have you around. Now, for the first time, I can say I know exactly where my children are. I know their hearts. I know what I need to be doing in their lives. I'm actually being a father. The teacher in Ecclesiastes has given us an important reminder that there is more to life than chasing that which is under the sun. There's more to life than chasing after what the world is chasing after money and materialism. Last week with Sam, we explored how there is a time for everything, a season for every activity under the heavens, how in chapter 3, verse 11, God has set eternity in the human heart. We're looking for God. Creation is yearning to know its creator. And we are made to know our creator. And everything else is just a vain pursuit of vanity. We saw how in these seasons of life that include times of happiness and times of sadness, times of joy and times of sorrow, above it all is this sovereign God we are made to know. Now, when we come across this word sovereign, which is understood to mean from the dictionary as a supreme authority or power, yet in theology, in reference to God, it's speaking of God's lordship over things. It's a word that most Christians have no initial grievance with. I think most Christians would be happy with accepting that God is sovereign. Okay, sure, you might argue with how that plays a part in salvation, but most would happily declare we serve a sovereign God. It's something that is very easy to verbalize. So we as a Reformed church would say that He, God, has control over all things, authority over all things, and is present over all things. Everything happens according to His plan and His intention. But know this, whilst it may be one of the easiest doctrines for us to confess, it's also one of the hardest to believe, especially when the believer's life just plummets into the dark valley of suffering. So let me explain. Isn't it so easy to declare the sovereignty of God when your family's happy, when your job is going well, when you have money in your bank account, when church is going well, when life in general is happy? But what about when you get that bad news that your health is in question and you have terminal disease, God forbid? Or what if you find out you're being laid off your job, or your marriage hits the rocks and divorce is staring you in the face? What then say you about God's sovereignty? How easy it is to say God is sovereign, but what about when things go wrong and suffering comes knocking on your door? Do you believe in the sovereignty of God then? Because church, this is when we need to know it the most. And that's what I'd like to look at this morning. Now, in our passage today, the preacher King is highlighting the suffering of injustice. So today isn't going to cover every type of suffering, but he picks up on suffering several times throughout his book. But in this specific passage today, which one commentator describes as one of the Bible's darkest chapters, the preacher's first disappointment in his observations is that from chapter 6, verse 2, of how God gives some people vast amounts of money. He gives them possessions and he allows them to even become famous, yet they are not able to enjoy it. Strangers enjoy them instead. It's here today and then gone tomorrow. And when it's gone, it goes to a stranger. And the speaker says, this is just evil. And the phrase in verse 1 of chapter 6, and it weighs heavily on mankind, implies that this is something that is happening all the time, again and again, which I think is fair to say it's true of today. We see people unfairly profiting off the backs of others, do we not? Verse 3, the next person described is someone who lives a long life, say 2,000 years, and yet despite achieving prosperity, still finds no satisfaction in life. There's something missing. And again, this is something that we see and hear with the rich and the famous and the wealthy today, do we not? Building up mass fortunes, but still lacking happiness. I was moved again by the testimony of world heavyweight boxer Tyson Fury. He was named after Mike Tyson. He had this huge expectation on his shoulders that he would likewise be the heavyweight champion of the world. The hunger and the drive was there all throughout his childhood, into his amateurs and his professional boxing career. But having achieved it all when he defeated Vladimir Klitschko in Germany for the heavyweight championship of the world, the next day he said it felt like he just descended into this deep, dark pit of suffering. The person here in the passage likewise does not find satisfaction in life, even in his abundant prosperity. In fact, for this man, despite having 100 kids, imagine that, despite having all of these children, no one gives him a proper burial, which was a great sadness for the teacher. Now, I can resonate somewhat. I, or our family, we weren't able to attend my grandfather's funeral during COVID. He was a good man that lived a good, full life. And yet, on what should have been a day of celebration and a fitting funeral was 10 socially distanced offspring, 2 meters apart. The writer says here, when you consider the suffering and how it all ends up for people, so that the way in which many people go through life and end up the same. Maybe it's better if we just weren't born at all. When the preacher contemplates in the predicament of a stillborn who doesn't endure pain, he doesn't see suffering, rather the child dies and immediately finds eternal rest. The underlying frustration of the teacher is elsewhere too throughout the book. So chapter 5 verses 13 to 14, he says, I have seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owners, or wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when they have children, there's nothing left for them to inherit. They take nothing from all of their hard work. Chapter 8 verse 14 says, the righteous get what the wicked deserve, and the wicked get what the righteous deserve. And at the heart of this frustration, his frustration is a sense that it all just seems so unfair. This doesn't fit with his Hebraic understanding of retribution and of how a judiciary system should work on earth, i.e. the guilty get punished and the good should get rewarded. You get what you deserve. Now, I think most of us would work along these very lines as well. But because life just doesn't work this way, we perhaps also have questions towards God. We're not willing to search for them in the Bible, but rather we shake our fist at God and say that it's meaningless. What's the point of being good? Some even give up altogether, like Socrates said, when he said, I evade death's sting by dying to the world in advance, disassociating myself from the body so that when physical death arrives, I'm no longer home to receive it. He simply checks out. Where is God in such suffering? If God is real, why doesn't he do something about the deep unfairness and injustices that we see taking place? If God is real, why does he allow such a horrible virus to come and kill so many? Why doesn't he stop it? You know the questions I mean, and perhaps you've heard them being asked today. Amongst your friends, amongst your family, amongst your community. Some scholars deduce that maybe God is just a moody God who just pours out good on those he chooses whenever he is in a good mood. But this cannot be true, can it? So what then? Does God have nothing to say on these injustices, on the suffering of his people? Here, as we've seen in the passage in Ecclesiastes, when a person works so hard, lives a good, clean, honest life, and yet he suffers so much. These are the observations of the teacher who, when he sees it, becomes so frustrated. But he doesn't stay there. Brothers and sisters, there's nothing wrong with asking God, where are you in this situation, in this suffering? We see that in the collection of the Psalms. It's all about this. Honestly ask him, where is God? And there is a difference between shaking your fist at the heavens and questioning God's sovereignty and reverently pouring out your heart and asking God, where are you? So although there is this underlying frustration from the teacher, it's like from chapter 3, he's already prepping us for the answer. He's dropping in subtle reminders that behind these frustrations and under this suffering, under the sun, is beyond it a higher power that is God. Now remember where Solomon, the preacher teacher, is taking us on this journey to the end of his observation. It's all heading towards chapter 12, verse 13. Which is where he says, now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God. Martin Luther said on this, this is what it means to fear God, to have God in view, to know that he looks at all of our works and to acknowledge him as the author of all things, aka sovereign. Brothers and sisters, what I present to us today is that no, I don't believe that any of our suffering is meaningless, not one second of it. Why? Because I believe that the Bible clearly shows us that even in and through our pain and suffering, God is in fact at work and he is totally sovereign over it all. Okay, so back to what does it mean for God to be sovereign? Well, if you believe that God is fully sovereign, then you must by definition believe there is nothing that he cannot do. Everything is under his control, even suffering. Yes, even suffering. In fact, God even allows his people to go through it and at times ordains it. You say, Pastor, you don't really believe that, do you? God is good and he only gives good things to his children. Suffering and pain and hurt is from the devil. But I don't believe that. I don't believe that's what the Bible teaches. Look at Job, perhaps the oldest book in the Bible. Job, like the teacher, had much wealth and success. He was blameless and he feared God. He was very successful and was the greatest of all of his people. Everything was going well for Job. That was until Satan appeared before God in this strange scene, has a conversation with him, which results in Satan being allowed to test Job. Satan says, if you stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, he will surely curse you to your face. To which the Lord said to Satan, very well, then he is in your hands, but you must spare his life. And off he goes and inflicts Job in unspeakable ways. He takes his family, his possessions and his reputation away. And yet none of this suffering happens without the permission of God. Job was tested. And as you might in response try and moralize the story and say, well, that all sounds a bit unfair, doesn't it? But it doesn't stop God being God. And besides, who are we anyway to question or to decide whether God is unfair? What does Job say? Job says, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. And God, having seen Job's character, tested him and he's proven to be faithful, restores him and some, gives him back everything. And we are reminded that none of this happened without God allowing it to be so. Look at Joseph. Joseph was the youngest in his family amongst his brothers. They were all jealous because their father Jacob loved him the most. And so they threw him in a pit and sold him as a slave. And what we see is a sequence of events that left Joseph unfairly punished and spending many years unfairly treated, laboring in prison. And yet at the end of the story, we read the most profound of acknowledgements from Joseph himself, who says to his brothers in response to all of the evil that they had done and throughout all of his suffering, he says, what you meant for evil, God meant it for good. God uses Joseph's misfortunes and sufferings to bring him to a place where he can rescue God's people. So God not only allows suffering, but he ordains suffering. And it's not without a purpose. The minute you start to say suffering is not under the divine care of God is to elevate Satan to a position of power that is equal footing with God. Now, this was a heresy in the common church that was known as dualism, where good and evil are equally ultimate and powerful, like a good action movie where the enemy can as equally defeat the hero and give him a good run for his money. But again, the Bible doesn't teach this. So whilst we don't deny that Satan is a very powerful person or the reality of the demonic, we do reject dualism and the belief that God is constrained in some way or unable to override any situation. We believe that God created Satan. He is a finite creature and not an infinite creator. The Bible teaches that the devil and evil trembles at the name of Jesus. We see this throughout the book of Mark, for example. Satan is absolutely no match for God. It's not, oh, who will win this time? No, it's God will and God has. Nothing happens without a sovereign God, both allowing it to happen. A sovereign God who's fully able to step in and change it. And I believe a sovereign God that also ordains it. The difficult question is, why does he? Or how should we respond? So how should the believer respond? Well, it's hard to find the answer in this chapter, which ends, who knows? But let me try and suggest a couple of ways in which the believer should respond. Firstly, the believer shouldn't be surprised when we go through times of hardship and persecution, suffering. Suffering, says Paul, is part of the Christian life. The Apostle Peter said, don't consider it a strange thing when you suffer. One of the dangers of a lot of modern and popular teaching coming out of God TV and from movements like Bethel and other feel-good preachers like Austin or Joyce Meyer and so on, is a distancing from suffering and towards an over-realized prosperity. And a simple survey of the New Testament shows us nowhere when we come to Christ, does it say it is plain sailing without trials and suffering? Nowhere does it say when you come to Christ in this life that you will be guaranteed to be healthy. Nowhere does it say when you come to Christ in this life, you will be wealthy. The message of the New Testament is not that in coming to Christ and accepting him as Lord, everything will go well as you understand it. But the message is that in Jesus, we find all that we need and we come to him not for his benefits, although of course we enjoy those, but we come to him for him himself. And my problem with this false message that is being pumped out is that it doesn't match up with real life. Did you know that my family and I, we went nearly 3 months without having a McDonald's. Now, don't be sitting there in your living room judging us, saying, oh, they go to McDonald's. So when that opened up the other week, we were pumped. The kids were ecstatic. We showed up at the drive-thru. We saw those luscious pictures. I mean, who could resist those burgers? And then when you get home and you open up your box and it looks like Gandalf's flip-flop, doesn't it? It's not what they said it would be or what they were telling us it would be like. And this is my worry with how some people present the gospel. If it's only the good bits, but there's no mention of suffering for Christ, we're selling a false gospel. And when the convert's been sold this, Jesus loves you, if you want to go to heaven, just say this simple prayer and in you go. But that person hasn't been warned that there will be spiritual attacks for the believer and suffering will come. What are they going to do when suffering comes as a complete surprise to them? Let me try and illustrate this further for you. Imagine you're on a plane and the air stewardess comes to you and says, here, put this parachute on. You oblige. But after a while, it's getting uncomfortable and awkward. The stewardess squeezes past you and spills Starbucks all over your lap. What's more, everyone is looking at you wearing this flipping parachute and they're laughing because you're wearing it on a perfectly sound plane. And so what do? You question, why am I even wearing this thing in the first place? And so you just throw it off. Now imagine you're on a plane and the air stewardess comes to you and says, here, put this parachute on. It's going to save your life. We're about to go through some extremely terrifying turbulence and there's every chance the plane won't make it. So put it on because, as I said, this may save your life. Now, likewise, the trolley steward comes, spills Starbucks over you. Do you resent your parachute? No, of course you don't. People start laughing at you and they question, why are you holding on to this thing? Do you start questioning yourself? No, you hold on tighter because you know that what you're holding on to is going to save your life. Do you see the difference? So we understand that in coming to Christ, the flight is going to get bumpy. We've been promised that all throughout the New Testament, it tells us this. And it's going to result in tragedy unless we have a hold of this parachute. So we should not be surprised. Second, the believer shouldn't be shaken. Brothers and sisters, we should always check when we're suffering. And we should always be honest and open and come to the Holy Spirit and ask to that he would point out anything in us that we may have done that's offended God, any hidden sin. Maybe we've slipped into worldliness described of the teacher in Ecclesiastes, a chasing after worldliness, and we've elevated these things above God. But then it may not be. As we have seen in Ecclesiastes and in this particular chapter, there is a suffering that happens to all people, even to the righteous. But that doesn't mean we lose perspective. That doesn't mean we start doubting God's love and declare it's all meaningless. We must not be shaken in this way. We know that the same God who is sovereign over all things has not allowed us to go through anything that he will not give us the ability and strength to cope with, that he will not walk through with us through it. We understand that it is not meaningless and it is not without purpose. And therefore, not only will we not be shaken, but we should respond by embracing it. It's for our good because we're trusting in God for it to be so. It's why the Apostle Peter writes, but when you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow in his steps. And later in his letter, Peter writes, but rejoice, to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings. Rejoice when you suffer, that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. If Jesus suffered, and we are called to walk his path, to follow him and to imitate him, surely we should then not, we should expect to also suffer likewise. So we should be very wary of teachers, preachers that say otherwise. Look at the facts objectively. Consider, for example, the apostles. Did God love them? Of course. Did God have good plans for them? Of course. What were those good plans? To suffer and die horrendous deaths. Every one of them, maybe with exception to John. Look at the immense suffering of the early church that were made spectacles of. They were torn to pieces by wild animals in the Colosseum. They were set on fire and showcased as human tortures. Look at our church fathers who were persecuted and suffered not only at the hands of oppressors and evil, but with loneliness, with the loss of children and depression. Look at our Christian brothers and sisters this very moment today in Nigeria being persecuted and murdered for their faith in Jesus. Suffering is part of God's plan for us. It's in fact more strange if you're not suffering in some way. The question is, what is God saying and doing? And do I believe he is enough and able to see me through it? Some of you know that one of the worst times in Amy and my life was losing our first child. We were so excited for Amy to be pregnant, but due to complications, the baby died in the womb. And Amy had to take some pills and give birth to our first son, which we called Elijah. As a new Christian who came from a background that meant I suppressed all my feelings, I found this so incredibly difficult to cope with. I can remember taking myself off to the toilet and crying out to God, saying, why? Why is this happening to us? I thought it was all supposed to be okay as a Christian. And through that dark valley, I felt the love of God in a profound way. And whilst it didn't at the time provide all the answers I was seeking, it was enough to just trust him through these dark times. Yet despite the pain of doing so, God has used it on several occasions for us to be able to come alongside other hurting parents to say, keep trusting in God. Keep believing that he is good, that he hears your pain and sees your sorrow and loves you so much, to keep believing that he is truly sovereign over your suffering, and to keep hoping that he can step in at any moment and make the impossible possible. Yet should he choose in his wisdom not to do so, we must join in, and we want to join in with Job and say, though he slay me, yet my heart will trust in him. Which is where I want to finish up. No, the believer is not exempt from the suffering of life. The New Testament, as we have seen, clearly teaches us that we should expect it. I expect it because I am in a fallen, broken world where there is so much pain and suffering. But I don't expect that it's out of God's control to rescue me from it. Or if he is as a sovereign, or that he has as a sovereign God ordained that I go for it. I know that the God of Job and of Joseph will be with me, and that there is a purpose and a plan that will bring honor to his good name. It's like the story of a little boy who was taken to a famous pianist called Paderewski, a concert by his mother. He slipped away from her, as kids do, and he made his way to the platform. He sat down at the concert piano, and in front of everyone, he started playing chopsticks, and the crowd reacted with anger and said, take the boy away! Paderewski, who was sitting at the back, realized what was going on, and he went to the piano, he gathered around the boy, and he began to play along with the boy, taking his weak efforts and making it into something beautiful. And he said and whispered into this boy's ear, as the story goes, don't quit, keep going. Keep going, and turned it into something beautiful and wonderful. How shall I respond? By the grace of God to suffering. I will not be surprised. I understand that as a follower of Jesus, this is the path I am called to follow. I will not be shaken. My confidence is in the Lord. It's not all meaningless, brother and sister. It's not all meaningless. It's doing something that only God can see. Therefore, I will not lose heart. I will trust in him. the one who himself suffered unjustly in securing my salvation. I will therefore trust in his goodness and in his promises that say in 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 19, therefore let those who suffer according to the will of God commit their souls to him in doing good as to a faithful creator. Peter 5:10, and the God of all grace who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, after you have suffered a little while, will himself restore you and make you strong, firm and steadfast. 2 Corinthians chapter 4:17, for our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs all of the suffering. And James 1:12, blessed is the one who perseveres under trial, because having stood the test, that person will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him. Brothers and sisters, I don't know how this finds you today. Maybe you find yourself being persecuted, suffering, and you resonate with what we've spoken today. Will you trust in the Lord? Will you believe that he is sovereign? Will you not be shaken? Will you stand firm and keep trusting in the Lord, knowing that he has a purpose for it and that through it all, he's working for the glory of his good name and for the building up of his church and of his saints, that we may be witnesses to a world that is lost and broken and suffering, that we may be able to point to something higher than the sun, and that is faith and a relationship in Jesus Christ, who alone is the answer to our suffering, who alone is the person in whom we will find true peace, true joy, and salvation. Church, be encouraged, be full of hope, stand firm in the faith. We believe and we trust in a sovereign God, even in the midst of our suffering.